Good afternoon. Good afternoon. Good afternoon and welcome to the National Press Club. My name is Monroe Carman. I am president of the Press Club and editor-at-large at Bloomberg Business News. I'd like to welcome club members and their guests here in the audience, as well as those of you watching on C-SPAN or listening to this program on National Public Radio or the Global Internet Computer Network. Before introducing our head table, I would like to remind you all of our upcoming speakers on Wednesday, tomorrow. Senator Chris Dodd, co-chair of the Democratic National Committee, and Haley Barbour, chairman of the Republican National Committee, will put their spin on the results of today's elections and tell what they mean for the upcoming presidential campaign. Tomorrow night, Wednesday night, we, the National Press Club, will present our 23rd annual Fourth Estate Award to Mr. Shirley Povich of the Washington Post for a lifetime of achievement in the field of journalism. Mr. Povich, as you know, was the distinguished sports writer and columnist for the Washington Post. I think our guest speaker probably recalls him to some degree. And he is 90 years old, and we all invite you to come and listen to the toasts and roasts tomorrow night. On Thursday, November 9th, Deputy Secretary of State Strobe Talbott will be on hand to discuss the Clinton administration's policy on Bosnia and other foreign policy subjects. And on Thursday, November 16th, choreographer Jacques D'Amboise, founder of the National Dance Institute, will address a Press Club audience. Transcripts and audio and videotapes of Press Club luncheons are available by calling 1-800-NPC-2334. And I'm also pleased to announce the publication of a new book. We've got lots of books here today. The new book, The National Press Club's Best Contemporary Speakers. This is a book that we've compiled that contains the best speeches of 1994 that were delivered right here at this podium. And I suggest that you might want to subscribe to a copy of this. You can do so by calling 1-800-NPC-2334. Also, I want to mention that the Friends of the National Press Club Library are raffling off a laptop computer to benefit the library, and tickets are for sale at the front desk as you go out. All right, with all that business behind us, if you have any questions for our speaker, you'll find cards at the table. Please write your questions on the cards, pass them up, and I will ask as many as time permits. Now I'd like to introduce our head table guests and ask them to stand briefly when their names are called. From your right, Mark Sandelow of the San Francisco Chronicle, Tori Minor of Copley News Service, Marty Tolchin, publisher of The Hill newspaper that covers Capitol Hill, Alan Adams, editor at Research Recommendations and chairman of the National Press Club Board of Directors, Deborah Howell, Washington Bureau Chief of Newhouse News Service, Bob Alden, editor at the Washington Post and past president of the National Press Club. Skipping over our speaker for the moment, Mark Johnson, Media General News Service and chairman of the NPC Speakers Committee, John Fogarty, editor of Kiplinger's California Letter, past president of the National Press Club, of the National Press Club, and member of the Speakers Committee who arranged today's luncheon. Thank you, John. Adrian Jordan, associate producer at CBS Evening News. Charles Lewis, Washington Bureau Chief of Hearst News Service. And Warren Rogers, freelance writer and past president of the National Press Club. And John Heilman of The Economist magazine. Thank you very much, all. Our guest today is the author of a new book entitled A Good Life, the fast-paced, dramatic account of an extraordinary career of a man who has been in the public eye for his entire professional life. No, I'm not talking about Richard Milhouse Nixon. He couldn't come today, but we do have Benjamin Crowninshield Bradley, Jr. Like it or not, Benjamin Bradley and Richard Nixon are joined forever. It was under Bradley's direction that the Washington Post, 20 years ago, exposed the Watergate scandal for all to see. And it was the Watergate scandal that forced Nixon to become the first United States president to resign that office and has kept every successor president on his toes. As Bradley writes in the foreword to his memoir, quote, "It is wonderfully ironic that a man who so disliked and never understood the press did so much to further the reputation of the press, and particularly the Washington Post. In his darkest hour, he gave the press its finest hour." While Watergate may have been the finest hour, a good life, much more than Watergate. It is an absorbing primer on the conundrums encountered in the practice of modern journalism. Ben Bradley's intimacy with the late John F. Kennedy's ascendancy to the White House has raised the nagging question to whether a journalist can or should ever become a close friend to a prominent public official. Mr. Bradley's historic victory for the press in the legal fight over publication of the Pentagon Papers spotlights the conflict between the public's right to know and the federal government's duty to protect the national security. Bradley's willingness to break from the routine in gathering and publishing the news, no matter what the cost, the Washington Post won 18 Pulitzer Prizes under his direction, illustrates the conflict between the pursuit of news and the pursuit of profit. Unfortunately, among the most memorable prizes won by the Post was the one that wasn't. Pulitzer that had to be returned because the reporter invented the entire story. That embarrassment highlights another journalistic dilemma. How much trust should editors invest in their reporters? I'm sure our guests will discuss these and other high and low points his brilliant career. As for his biography, most of you know it, Harvard, service on a Navy destroyer in World War II, entry into journalism in New Hampshire, reporting at the Washington Post from 1948 to 1951, a stint as press attaché in the U.S. Embassy in Paris, European correspondent for Newsweek, chief of the magazine's Washington Bureau in 1961, and then back to the Post as managing editor in 1965, and executive editor from 1968 to 91. It's all set forth in his book, A Good Life, and now a warm National Press Club welcome for the author, Benjamin C. Bradley.
I am so overexposed. I have been on any radio station that has at least 250 watts. I have been on it. I have repeated myself so often. The other day, Catherine Graham gave a book party for me, and she said some very nice things, and I got up to respond and started telling an anecdote, because that's what you do when a radio host asks you a question. And about a third of the way down the road, I realized that this anecdote had absolutely nothing to do with Catherine Graham, and it would take an incredibly powerful transition to wrench it around so that it did have anything. I looked out in the audience, and there was my wife, Sally Quinn, saying, "Oh, no, no." My editor here, when I got down for the first time in 1948, was Russ Wiggins, one of the really brilliant men I've been lucky enough to know. And he said there was only one rule, and that is to stay off the stage. What a joke that has become, despite trying. It's been a joke for a long time. Wiggins loved me because when I got down out of the hills of New Hampshire, he came up with a good first assignment for me, which was to, he hated gambling, Wiggins. He hated bookies, he hated numbers, he hated any suggestion that a lottery might be coming. We said, why don't we make, to Ben Gilbert, the city editor, why don't we make Bradley, turn Bradley loose on the bookies? They've never heard of him. They wouldn't recognize him. And Gilbert thought that was a good idea, and he gave me the assignment. I walked back to the sports section and asked Mo Siegel. I said, Mo, who are the bookies in this town? And he took out a pencil and a sheet of paper, and he wrote 16 names down with their telephone numbers. And I thought that was a little soon to go back to Wiggins with a list of 16 bookies. So I let the weekend go by, and on Monday morning I showed up, and Russ said, turned to Gilbert, and he said, we got a hell of a new guy here in Bradley. life became difficult. It became difficult to stay off the stage. Nixon, and I never missed a chance to thank him for all he's done for me, made it impossible. He made folk heroes, really, out of Woodward and Bernstein. And what he didn't do, Redford and Jason Robards finished off. But as I sat down to find out what the hell I had really done in my 74 years on this earth, I realized that I showed a certain facility for intruding into a story fairly early. I hadn't been in Washington very long when I lived out in Georgetown, and I got a trolley to work every morning. And one morning I was taking the trolley, and as it straightened off of Pennsylvania Avenue for that run across the White House, a gunfire broke out. And I was, as a result, the first person on the scene for the the two Puerto Ricans, Colazzo and whatever the hell the other guy, Torresola, who were trying to shoot their way into Blair House, where President Truman was. And I'm probably the only person you know who has crawled across Pennsylvania Avenue on his knees and elbows sober. But I had a story on the front page of the Post the next morning over Chow Roberts and Murray Marta's dead body. But what is you giving this new guy a byline so early for? But I had been lucky. A few weeks after that, I left Basson's restaurant, which some of you may remember, which was down the street there, and on the corner of...
Is that you, Ben?
No, I couldn't see it. On the corner of 14th and E, and as I got out, I looked up across on the Willard Hotel, and if those of you who can visualize it, there is an iron railing that runs across the 12th floor of the, it forms that corner overlooking 14th and the avenue. And I looked up there, and there was a GI who was, he looked to be about 12 years old, and he had just climbed out over the railing, had his arms in back of it, and was swaying back and forth in the middle of the day. And I, never mind that I had a six-month-old baby, I rushed over to the Willard, went up to the 12th floor, counting him like this, from the F Street side so I'd get it right. And I saw the open window, and I crawled out on that window between the fence and the thing all the way to the corner, and I listened to the cops talk this guy back, and then I backed off. And there was a great picture taken by Huey Miller. There couldn't be anybody here who knows or remembers Huey Miller. Just one. And Huey Miller had himself taken this picture from the roof of the Post building, and even my mother couldn't recognize me, but there was this little figure crouched behind it. And that was a dumb thing to do, I think, now, after all these years. Not only was I in danger of slipping or the fence breaking, but I was in danger of interfering with this guy's rescue. But he was rescued, and I got away with that. As a foreign correspondent for Newsweek, I had the idea of trying to cover, get behind the enemy lines in Algeria to talk to a rebel chieftain. I'd forgotten his name, but I think it was Benbella, probably. I had met an Algerian rebel in Paris, and he said if I went down on such a date, I'd be contacted, and then we'd go up to the through the mountain pass to the Kabul Mountains, and I'd have a great exclusive interview. Except that somewhere along the line, I bumped into an agent provocateur, I think, because I went to a bar, and then in through the kitchen of the bar, and into another bar, out through that door, into something else. Finally ended up in a car. I was blindfolded and taken up to the mountains, and halfway up the mountains they stopped, and they came back and said, I'm sorry, the pass, the snow has covered the pass, it made it impassable, and we can't go. I went back to my hotel, waited for another couple of days, went back to Paris, and the day I got to Paris, as I got out of the taxi from the airport, you never seen so many cops in your life outside the Herald Tribune building where I was, my office was, and they arrested me, and I desperately searched, I think I pride myself on my French, but I couldn't remember the word for warrant. It wouldn't have done me a damn bit of good, but I kept thinking, what the hell is in there? And it's mandat damné, in case any of you French scholars. But I learned that the next day, and much too late. And I was expelled from France as a result of that. I never actually left because it was rescinded. But the expulsion order was enough to get my picture on page one of the Post. They had a residual interest in me. And the Herald Tribune, anyway, I was obviously coming up, and as my profile got a little higher, I began interfering more and more with the news. I got a little bit higher up that ladder. I'm not sure it's the right ladder, but it was the one I was on when totally accidentally, Kennedy and his wife and one child at that time moved in about three houses from where I was living with my wife and a whole slew of stepchildren and one real child. And we became friends because I didn't mean to say that. That isn't... Editors need editors. My stepchildren were stepchildren for 16 years, and they were very real children. We met pushing baby carriages along N Street and ended up in each other's gardens and at someone's house that night, and we ended up that day friends. And that doesn't seem to be as much of a problem as it does to my colleagues. Let me tell you something, that if you assign a reporter to cover a mayor, a governor, even a presidential candidate, if he's any good or she, they are going to become friends. If they're not going to become friends, they're going to die on the vine. They're going to get their tails beaten every day, and so a friendship develops. It can be a different kind of a relationship. It could be loathing, I suspect, if you really hated the guy, but I don't think you'd get much news. The question then is, if the guy goes on to succeed, whether the reporter involved has to resign from the human race. I don't think he does. You can't imagine the built-in safeguards that exist. In my case, I was working for Newsweek then. I never covered Kennedy in the White House, but I covered him up to the White House. And I'm telling you that the most faithful reader of the Newsweek dispatches about Kennedy was Hugh Seide of Time magazine. He went through that like a fine-tooth comb. And if he found too many good things in my stories that he didn't have, he whined his way in to see President or candidate Kennedy or Salinger and said, you got to stop doing this. And so for the next 3 or 4 weeks, you'd see all the goodies showing up in Seide's column. The other, of course, never mind the built-in safeguard that the reporter brings to this. Most good reporters don't want to go down as a coat carrier or as a water carrier for any politician, and I certainly didn't. And the final thing is your editors. The Newsweek editors love the little bits, anecdotes that I was able to produce for them, but mostly they dined out on them. They didn't run them because they said, well, that's too complimentary to Kennedy, so we won't run that. But boy, did they have a good time in their little clubs and hotels. I don't know. In the middle of my involvement with Kennedy, I did the smartest thing that I ever did in my whole life, which was to call Phil Graham up one night after a few pops, I'm sure, and said, "We're about to be sold to some ketchup merchant, and we don't want it. There's a bunch of us who don't want that, and we'd like to talk to you." And Graham said, "When?" And I said, "When could we do that?" And he said, "How about now?" It was 11 o'clock at night. I went over there, and I talked to Phil from 11 to 5 in the morning. And I didn't really know him that well. I'd worked for him for a couple of years. If those of you who follow the intricacies of a purchase of one big company by another will be stunned to know that 17 days after that meeting, he owned Newsweek, and he stole it. He absolutely stole it. He paid $15 million for it, but that didn't count $3 million that was in the bank in Newsweek's bank account. It didn't count $3 million that he eventually recouped for the Newsweek interest in the television station in San Diego. So now we're down to $9 million. It made $20 or $30 million a year in the first 2 or 3 years, and has been a pretty good investment for him. And for me, I might add. I got a little notoriety after that. More money, but a little notoriety. And then, I'm not really worried about it. I don't think I would assign a best friend or a good friend to cover a president. But if you think that's going to correct the potential dangers, you're crazy. What's to prevent the best friend from going to see going to the White House, having Kennedy tell him whatever, or whoever the president is, telling him whatever he wants? And what is this journalist going to do? He's not going to forget it. He's going to write a memo, send the memo to his colleagues, and it's going to show up in the paper if it's right. Anyway, along came Watergate, and the rest of our privacy pretty much vanished. I don't know what to tell you about Watergate. The thing that has interested me most this year about Watergate is rereading Republican comments by Republican leaders in the months of October and or the very first week in November. I know even the best of you will forget who were the spokesman for the Republican Party at that time. The most voluble and the one who hated and attacked the Post the most was my friend Bob Dole, who was head of the Republican National Committee. And he would speak, every single night. Certainly every evening there was a soundbite attacking the Post, attacking Catherine, attacking Woodward, Bernstein, Bradley, the whole bunch of them. Enough so that more than once those stepchildren that you thought I ignored, when I got home at night, they were in tears, saying, why is Senator Dole so mad at you? Of course, Dole was succeeded by George Bush, who became Republican National Committee Chairman. I included in my book the full text just to help you out with the flavor of a speech that Dole made, and it really makes interesting reading now. After Watergate, things seemed to quiet down a little bit with the major exception of Janet Cook. I'm not going to go into Janet Cook except to congratulate all of you who think that something like that can never happen in your organization. You're crazy. It can. If anybody wants to, anybody wants to work hard enough to establish that wonderful bond of trust that exists and has to exist between reporters and editors, if they want to then break it, look out, because they're going to do it. I'm really proud of one thing, Janet Cook, and that is that none of you knows anything about the Janet Cook case that the Washington Post didn't tell you 4 days later in that really wonderful piece by Bill Green, who was our ombudsman, who wrote 18,000 words, didn't go to bed for 2.5 days, and laid it all out, where we went wrong, how we screwed up, what we didn't do, what we should have done. And I thought it was an absolute miracle. After Janet Cook, I tried to get Janet Cook for this book, and I know one person who is in contact with her, and finally got to her, and she had no interest in talking to me. So that's the way that is. She had tried for a while to get to Hollywood and to sell herself as a potential movie, but without success. After Janet Cook, it seemed to me that the last 10 years of my time at the Post was spent in national security matters, or to print or not to print. Some of the to print, not to print decisions weren't totally involved with national security. There's only one national security matter that I disguised quite, I thought, artfully, but maybe clumsily. And one of the people involved in it is here tonight, so I better not go into it totally. But Let me tell you about one which you may have forgotten about if you know and may not even have known about it. Woodward, who figures in almost all of the my national security era stories, sidled into my office, because that's how he moves when he's got a good story that he wants to sell. And he said, he talks in that Midwestern accent, do you realize that we have a king in the Middle East on our payroll? And I said, you know, I didn't realize that. I figured out who the king was, since there was only one king there. But he said, as a matter of fact, the CIA gives Hussein of Jordan $1 million a year, not economic aid, not foreign aid, but walking around money. And this was, he could do anything he wanted with it. He could buy his kids water skis. He could spend, he could do anything he wanted with it. And I couldn't believe that, and I thought that it was terribly interesting. It was in February of 1977. Jimmy Carter had been president for 20 minutes. The Middle East, then as now, was a highest priority item on the president's agenda. And as we were beginning to investigate this and trying to figure out whether we'd run it or not, what that would do, would it upset the balance? There had been 14 attempts of on Hussein's life. I got a call from Jody Powell saying, would you be interested while you're making up your mind in seeing the president? Now, that doesn't happen very often in my experience in this town. So we were over there, Woodward and I were over there in about 10 minutes. Carter couldn't have been more friendly, more polite, more receptive, and he sat us down and made us feel comfortable. And the first thing he said was, it's true. Now, that never has happened before or since. We could throw away the 2 and 3 and 4 source rule that we developed with Woodward and Bernstein. Here was the lead dog telling us that this story was right. He then said that he had ordered it stopped. So not only did we have a great lead, but we had a great second paragraph. And before we could even regain our composure, he said that he hadn't known about it. This was the thing that ended up interesting us most of all. He said that he had been briefed by the Secretary of State, and he had been briefed by the Director of the CIA. In fact, he'd been briefed 3 times by the Secretary of State, name of Kissinger, and he'd been briefed twice by the CIA Director, name of George Bush again. And it hadn't come up. It just hadn't come up. And it began to suggest that perhaps these guys had not transferred the full pack of cards. They'd kept 3 or 4 in their pocket that might get them in danger, and that seemed to me to be not quite fair. Carter, he didn't come right out and say, you can't publish that, or I hope you can't publish that, or he didn't sic an attorney general on us, as certain other presidents have did later. But he made it perfectly clear that he would be much happier if we didn't. He particularly pointed out that Secretary of State Vance was due in Amman the next day. So out of an abundance of caution and good manners, we decided that we wouldn't run it the next day, even though we had it pretty damn well locked up by now. So we ran it the following day. I got a nice handwritten note from the president saying he thought I'd done a terrible thing, and that was the end of that. It was a brief note, which I treasure. Now, if you can take one more story that has got nothing to do with national security, I'll tell you about a day in the 80s when we were sitting around in the city room hanging out, which is the most fun of all in journalism, as you know. And we were talking about what had happened while each of us was on vacation. What had been the most interesting thing that had happened wherever we were? And we got some pretty good stories. But then Jane Amsterdam started her story. She had been an editor at the Post. She went on to become editor of the New York Post and several of those slick magazines in New York. And she told the following story about the member guest golf tournament in a Midwest area, okay? I'm holding out. somewhere between the Adirondacks and the Rockies. And the story was as follows, that the person who had aspired all his life to be the club champion was now the chairman of an independent department here in Washington, appointed by President Reagan, a former CEO of a Fortune 500 company. And he had the forethought to get a deputy who was a scratch golfer. And so the tournament started, and this high Reagan official, Reagan-appointed official, and the deputy ran away with the golf tournament. They just ran away with it. On the 17th hole of the second day, the last day, our hero did hook a drive into the rough. And he went there, saw his lie this way, saw the fairway lying 6 feet over, and he kicked the ball. He kicked it onto the fairway. He went from the fairway to the bottom of the cup in two or three strokes, and they won the golf tournament. And they went down to the locker room to get spiffed up for the ceremony where he was going to be congratulated by his wife and children and his buddies in the community. When his world fell apart, the chairman of the rules committee, the golf pro, and the president of the club interrupted him in his dressing and said that three people had seen him improve his lie, and therefore he had been disqualified. He did not win the tournament. They told him that he was no longer a member of this club, although they did tell him, curiously, that if he went to a psychiatrist for 2 years in Washington, they would allow him to apply again for membership. You can see we had some fair detail in this story. And that's where the story stopped when she told it. We decided that that was hands down the best story of that afternoon, and we would send a young reporter who was wanted to be a Woodward wannabe called Ben Weiser, who was fantastic at this. And he checked this story out, and he got every damn detail. He corroborated everything. He talked to the shrink. He talked to the rules committee. He talked to everybody and wrote the story. So then we had this moment of truth when we were going to decide, should we run it, should not run it, and are we picking on the Reagan administration? Is the guy really a high Reagan official? Answer, no. His agency was kind of small. It was independent and had 120 employees, but it was a stretch to call him. Anyway, in a move that I now second guess, I said, let's not run it. A lot of muttering about how Bradley had lost a step. In the old days, that would have been in the paper tomorrow morning. All sorts of things like that. Anyway, two or three days later, my wife and I went to the to one of those mass cocktail parties at the vice president's house. We were escorted through, pushed through the receiving line by Bush, and Mrs. Bush pushed us out into a little clearing on the, what must have been a dance floor. And I saw this good-looking fellow from the side, young guy, come look at me for a while and then sort of march towards me. And he said, well, you're Bradley, right? I said, I was. And he sort of shuffled for a minute like this. And he said, well, I might as well come right out and say it. I think that the Washington Post is the worst goddamn newspaper I ever heard. You never get it right. You're all commies, liberals, blah, 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 like that. About 2.5 inches right off the top of my head from a man I had never met before and whom I did not know. I asked after he delivered his message, I asked Vice President Bush, who's your friend? And Bush said, I've never seen him before in my life. And Bush had been listening. He heard this. I got one clue as to who he was from a remark he said that he'd been to Princeton and he'd been a classmate of Don Oberdorfer's. So armed with that, I went to work the next morning and I spotted Oberdorfer. And I said, who is this guy who's your great, great friend? And he's got, you know, and he told me, and you know what it was? It was the golf cheater. So, now we got a story, right? Except that we didn't. We didn't. I mean, cooler heads prevailed, and we decided that if we were right to not publish it in the first place, a decision I completely question now. It was hard to say that just because he'd taken 2.5 inches off my head that we ought to sting him. But what we did do is we wrote him a letter, I did, with the copy of Ben Weiser's story, saying that this story is not going to run in the paper that you admire so much. But if you ever decide to run for public office, I'm sure we will run it. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Now the hard part. I know you referred to the golf cheat as one story, but there have been several questions raised, and I wonder if you could recall another example, summed up by this one. Now, we all know the stories you went after, Watergate, Pentagon Papers, etc. What story did you not go after that you feel now you should have?
Well, I mean, there's a good list. Savings and loan, housing, those are two that we didn't even really go after. We went after after them so late that we cast no shadow at all on them. And I regret that. I find it hard to understand why. It's hard to list you all the stories that we don't know are happening out there, but those were two that we apparently didn't. The one that really I think baffles me most is Iran-Contra. We really went after that with everything we had. But we couldn't make anything stick. The country was not interested. The country seemed to have, they had a big shot prosecutor come down from New York, and they ate him for lunch down here. And the congressional inquiry got nowhere, as against the Watergate, where the congressional inquiry was so good and so strong. So you've got me wrong. I have no compunctions about admitting what we did wrong or what we missed. I hope we missed fewer than most, and if you have anything in mind now, I'll get the new guys on it right away.
What's your opinion of the decision by the New York Times and the Washington Post to acquiesce to the demands of the Unabomber to print the text of his writings?
Well, I have not been in on the decision-making process and things like that since 1991. They did ask me. Don Graham asked me to remind him about the previous incident, which was this bunch of Croatians who hijacked a plane out of Chicago, and after bopping around the world for a while, they came down with the demand that. Five newspapers publish a 3,500, not 1,000 word screed, really is the word for it, and all these people would be killed. And I remember being very anxious to have Catherine Graham and Donald Graham by my side as we made this decision, but ultimately it came down to, did anyone want to see a story saying that the next day's paper that 67 Americans were blown to bits because the Washington Post refused to run some essentially inconsequential screed. I thought they should have run it. I think when you have at long last in this town a really good FBI director, and he tells you that there is, he didn't tell me, he told Graham and Sulzberger and the two editors that there is a small, however small, chance that if you do this, that some clue will pop up that will help solve this crime. I didn't think it was a tough call.
Several questions. I'm going to try to summarize them again. On the New Republic story on the Post newsroom and race, how much does race have to do with hiring and story judgment at the Washington Post? And while diversity may be a good goal for newspapers or any industry, if the Post makes one of every four hires a minority and two of every four a female, how is that anything but a quota system?
Well, if anybody has got the courage to stand up here and saying that, to say that there isn't a determination to improve the numbers of women and minorities on the paper, and if you want to call it a quota system, I don't think it's a quota system because they say X percent, and you're going to get fired if you don't fill it up. But of course there's a determined system to improve the number and quality of females and minorities. That is a fact. And now, that doesn't bother me at all, because I think it's we will improve the sensitivity of the reporting staff at the Post. What does worry me is if people sort of say, God, aren't you guys just catering to the lowest common, you know, blah, blah, blah. Just say it any way you want. And it seems to me that New Republic article had slightly that tone, as belittling the existence of the problem. It's an enormous problem in newspapers, especially enormous problem in newspapers who are determined to do something about it. En route, if you hire women and minorities, you're going to displace normally, often, white males. That is not going to be the best news that the white males have heard for a while. But I question the New Republic's credentials here. As Don Graham said, they've been looking for a qualified black employee for 114 years. and Ruth Shalit has had her own particular problems with reporting that I'm not going to go into. But of course it's serious. Of course it's a problem. Of course, if you want to pour a little kerosene on it like that, it's going to make it harder to solve. But it's going to be solved, and we might as well understand that, and it's going to be for the good of the newspaper business.
Is the Metropolitan newspaper a journalistic dinosaur doomed to extinction? And if so, should we be looking for jobs in another profession?
Well, I've only worked for one newspaper, a daily newspaper, in my whole life. And I would bet you I'd put all the chips I have under the pot by saying that this daily newspaper, I think, is going to be around forever. It has got a fantastic franchise, to be sure. It has made itself, not totally accidentally, a must-read for the people who want to do business in this town, who want to really exist in this town. That is the challenge, is for us to make newspapers absolutely indispensable. I think, unfortunately, sometimes what gets threatened are the Washington correspondent thumbsuckers. That is generally not what a local metropolitan newspaper needs. It does need them here in this city, because this is we have this franchise where government is really in our backyard. But I think what worries me more is trying to get kids into our newspapers. My generation learned how to read in the newspapers. We learned how to do arithmetic by trying to figure out Rabbit Moranville's, I go back that far, Kevin, batting averages. And I don't see kids doing that now. But I think that is an interesting challenge. And I think if you make the paper overpoweringly necessary, just essential to your life, then I think newspapers will succeed. There are going to be fewer newspapers, and I hate to do anything but bemoan that. But if you were some almighty and your goal was to have an informed population, there is much more information out there now than there was when my father was reading newspapers. There are fewer newspapers, but the newspapers are better.
What's your view of the rise of talk radio as a forum for news? And also, this morning's New York Times reports that Microsoft has signed up Michael Kinsley as a reporter. Now, what do you feel, editor? All right. What do you feel are the implications for traditional journalism as more news and information is disseminated online and by firms without a traditional loyalty or background to the values of journalism?
Well, I don't know, but I know Kinsley well, and I like him, and I think he's really got an interesting mind.
And I don't know what the hell he's doing in that or what he's going to do. But he's going to be good at it, I'll tell you that. As far as talk radio, this is the what I've learned since I've been out on the speaker's tour of promoting a book. You cannot believe the amount of talk radio. I mean, if you think the talk radio is Imus and Limbaugh and Colonel North, you're crazy. There are thousands of them out there, and they talk endlessly. And they ask the same questions. All of them ask the same questions. And they're all popular. They're incredibly glib. They are popular. I don't confuse them with news, though. I don't think there's a hell of a lot of news on them. There's a lot of opinion. And but it is the new to me phenomenon in America today is the amount of talk radio. Just stunning.
A couple of questioners ask you to look back about 30 years. You were close to President Kennedy, but now, 30 years later, would you look back on his presidency and how do you rate it? And secondly, what is your view today of Lyndon Baines Johnson? He has been known to give Washington, had been known to give Washington Post reporters misinformation in the Oval Office. Did you have the same trust of him as you apparently did of Jimmy Carter?
Well, I don't trust any of them. I don't. I mean, if a reporter that gets in to see the president doesn't think the president is going to try to manipulate the story that's going to result from that, he's just being naive. Of course they're going to do that. And but I mean, I think that's a given. That ought to have been taught the day you went to by your first editor. Look out for what he says. Look out for those guys. And you've got to check it. I don't think Kennedy, I don't know, let's put it this way, of instances in which Kennedy lied the way I have seen subsequent presidents lie. As far as women, which I can see forming in your mind this question, I'm going to remind you that he was never asked. Reporters either didn't know. In my case, I saw Kennedy probably 140 times, almost all of them with my wife and his wife and no one else. And horsing around is a subject that does not come up in that milieu. I promise. If I think back on... did you ask what do I think of
Johnson?
Oh, what do I think of Kennedy's presidency? I thought that his relationship with the gangster's girlfriend showed a proclivity for risk that I don't think belongs in the White House, and I doubt if he could have survived it if people knew about it. But it doesn't end up by changing my feeling that this was the president that the one president I knew who made America feel that they had a sense of purpose and a sense of hope and a confidence in themselves that I don't see anymore.
Thank you. Speaking of women, these come up from the audience.
I understand.
Not from me. Why is adultery okay for newspaper men, but not for politicians? And secondly, it's not over with yet. Is there any woman with whom you slept who is not mentioned in your book and you wish to mention now?
Well, answer to the first question is that if you have in mind what I think you have in mind, there are no lies involved. Think of that for a minute. No, the journalist that you're talking to the best of my knowledge, told no lies. The politicians that I know about, to the best of my knowledge, tell a lot of lies on the subject. The answer to the second question, no to the first half of the second question, and no to the second half. I don't want to talk about that. Adultery was spelt wrong in that question, in case you're wondering.
I didn't write it. Do you believe the general public will ever learn the identity of Deep Throat? And if so, when?
I think the general public will learn it the day after he dies, provided that Downey and Woodward are on the job, and I have every reason to believe they will be. Woodward has identified Deep Throat as a living male. He has said that he would identify him on his death, and he said he has made arrangements that if either he or Bernstein predeceased Deep Throat, the Deep Throat will be identified by somebody. I don't know who, lawyers or...
Quick question now. Several members of the audience want to know, how many books do you have to sell before you start thinking of announcing yourself as a presidential candidate?
There aren't that many trees. There aren't that many trees.
Well, before we get to the last question, sir, we thank you very much for being with us. I have a couple of gifts for you, a certificate of appreciation.
Thank you very much.
And one of our famous National Press Club mugs, where you can sit out on the veranda and sip coffee and think of us.
I will. I'll think of some of those questions, sir.
Last question. Now, we've checked the National Press Club records, and we found...
I still owe money?
That your membership has expired for non-payment of dues. Is this a good time to clear that up, do you think?
It just expired, didn't it? I don't owe you a nickel.
It's expired, yeah, that's
yeah.
All. If you'd like to rejoin, that's what we're
Well, saying. I'll give it every thought, I'll tell you that. Thank you all very much.
I just want to point out the contributions of Melissa Bender, Pat Nelson, Melanie Abdo-Dermott, and Howard Rothman for organizing today's lunch, and I thank you all for being with us. Good afternoon. Thank you very much. Thank you, Jack. Thank you. Thank you. You enjoy that one?
Fun. Good to see you back in the center.
Thank you. That went all right.
Yeah, that was lovely. I thought the misspelling. Have you read the book?
Yeah, I read it over the weekend. Yeah.
I couldn't believe some of the language. You know.
You like that one?
Yeah. What a miserable bastard you are, last question.
We should ask you, it was a live one.
Live? Oh, really? Wow, I don't know what we got away.
What'd you ask?
Is it okay to, why is it okay for newspaper, is this still on? No.
Yeah, I think the public address.
Why is it okay for newspaper men to commit adultery and not public officials?
You know, you're as rash as Bradley.
That's a good one.
So I said it, you know, I gave it a look. This is not mine. That even comes up from
the door. Of course, right. Glad you're back in the South. Hey, listen, did you get a chance to...
I'm not going to do that.
Huh? Can't do it?
I don't want to.
Okay.